How to do it, Michelle?
How to do it, partner? How's it going?
I'm all right. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm good.
Had a good week?
I've had a great week. I'm just a little concerned that you thought my appearance was that I just got out of bed.
Rolled out of bed, I think, is what I said. I'm sorry, Michelle. Oh, I see you've got a pretty sun frock on. Is that a frock?
I do. Oh. I do have a frock.
I thought it was pajamas.
Oh, fuck's sake.
Sorry. But it's pretty. But you've got everything that you own is gorgeous, Michelle. You always look so well turned out.
Thank you. And so do you.
Run a brush through the hair. That's all.
Yeah, this is not the first time you've said that to me.
My mother would always say that. Hey, speaking of Robin, my mum, I believe she did listen to last week's cleaning episode.
Oh, yeah? Good.
And I had sent you some photos this morning of her new pad. They've done up a Welsh dresser. They've got all their knickknacks out and they're much more streamlined. There's no singing frog. It wasn't a singing frog. It was a guitar playing frog. She said she can't find that. And she said, you're absolutely right. Our generation has no interest in their knickknacks. That's why they sold them all and made loads of money. Go, Mum.
Oh, go, Robin.
Go, Mum.
Cash in the attic.
Yep.
That's what it is. Oh, brilliant. Yeah, no, I saw those pictures. Looks fantastic.
I know. I love the native Australian arrangement on the bed.
Very nice. Very nice. It was like it was almost like an Ayers rock kind of.
The tones.
Ochre tones. Ochre. Yes.
Yep. And a lot of cane as well. I love a bit of cane.
So talking of knickknacks, yes. I read this crazy thing, as you do.
As you do.
It was about Gwyneth Paltrow. Did you read about this?
No. What's she done to her vagina now?
Well, funny you should talk about her vag.
It's always about her vag, isn't it?
It is all about her goopy vag. But
Michelle!
What? She runs Goop.
Okay.
Goop's her website.
Right.
Come on.
Don't say goopy
get
vag,
with
though.
It.
That's not nice.
A goopy vag, no.
It's
at least it's not droopy, whoopy, puffy, waffy.
What?
Anyway, that's my sister will understand that reference.
Oh,
anyway,
God.
Moving right along. She had a complaint this week.
Who? Gwyn?
And her vag. So a guy called Colby Watson, who lives in Texas, is taking Gwyneth Paltrow to court.
Oh, I see. The complaint's against her. It's not her complaining.
Yes. No, no. He is taking her, he's suing her for $5 million.
She's got
in
it.
In damages.
She'll have it somewhere.
She will. She's got it tucked up into her fanny box. Anyway, in a vag.
God!
So, well, we're talking about vag because this dude, Colby, suing her for $5 million because he bought one of her vagina candles called This Smells Like My Vagina Exploded. The vagina candle exploded and he said he'd burned it for 3 hours before it exploded and became engulfed in high flames.
Oh my God.
Leaving a black burn ring on his table and the candle jar charred and black. Dude wants $5 million for this.
Well, I was going to say that's quite excessive, isn't it? $5 million for a burnt ring on his.
He wasn't even injured.
A burnt ring.
He just had a burnt ring.
From her vagina. Goodness me.
But can I just say, and I don't want to bring up the idea of fanny juice again.
Oh!
Who wants a candle that smells like that? And especially Gwynnie's.
No. Well, she's obviously going to, it's going to be like the Instagram filter where she's got no wrinkles and her triple chin has been, you know, wiped away. And so she's going to edit the candle or the smell of her vagina as well, because no one else is going to be able to say, it doesn't smell like that. Are they? Apart from her ex-husband.
Yeah, Chris Martin might have a word or two to say about that. But, yeah, I guess this dude just wanted his house to smell like vagina, like the fresh
God.
Scent of vagina. No, but why else would you buy a candle?
Yeah, why would you buy that? Why would you buy it?
Why would you buy? And it was actually called This Smells Like My Vagina. That was the name of the candle. And it looked really elegant.
I've got issues with that. I mean, why? Why? I mean, I can see it's probably an extreme marketing ploy. But why would you say that? Oh, come on, Gwyneth. Don't.
Well, might get taken off the market now. She might
I
be five
so.
Mil down after this. So anyway.
No, they can't. Obviously,
I don't know who. I just don't know
couple
who I'm
of grand,
rooting for
but
in
not
this.
Five mil.
5 mil's a lot.
It's too much.
I mean, I guess, do you know what? If you're going after Gwyneth, you're going to go for all you can
go
get,
big,
aren't you?
Yeah.
Go big or go home. But yeah, I'm just not sure whose side I'm on. Do I root for dude who bought it, like, dodgy
vagina candle?
They're
both ridiculous. They are both ridiculous people. And I don't give a crap what happens to either of them. I don't give a hoot.
I don't give a veg about it anyway. So that was what I read, and I was shocked.
That is shocking.
Shocked and horrified. And I had realised it's been quite a while since we've talked about our love and our patron saint.
Oh, Ben!
Mendels!
Ben Mendels!
We haven't talked about him for ages.
We haven't.
It's nothing to say.
You two better watch out. We don't like innocents around here.
Poor old Ben. What's he up to? Is he out of work, do you think, Michelle, again?
Career's over.
No, it'll never be over for him.
No, it won't. It won't.
Do you know Australia is the new Hollywood? Because they've all gone out there. How are they being allowed in and out of Australia and where not?
Because the Australian government does not give a fuck if you've got money enough to get in. They let you in it during this pandemic.
They've
but
said
if you're
it's
like,
shut. Both ways.
Yeah, bullshit. It's all backhanders behind the bike shed. Who knows?
Backhanders. Anyway. Well, I'll tell you what, Michelle. That's what my story is full of them today.
We are talking all about today.
Because we've missed it, haven't we? Our favourite show.
We have. We've been bereft and forlorn about not having.
Bereft and.
Well.
What?
Bereft.
Bereft. And forlorn. Oh, forlorn.
Forlorn. What did you think I said? The lawn.
The lawn.
I'm just on the lawn.
I've been bereft on the lawn ever since Line of Duty finished 3 Sundays ago. Oh, it's not been great not having it there anymore, but it's made me think about it a lot. And I did find a great podcast to listen to, which I'll tell you about later, which has kind of filled my Sunday gaps.
Well, you wanted to do this week's topic.
I did, Line of Duty, because I love it. Because there is some real life stories that the wonderful writer Jed Mercurio was inspired by. You know, that it might seem far-fetched, all these OCGs, which stands for Organised Crime Gang. And is that right? OCG?
Cheers.
Cheers, which is I've got that in my story, a cheers, because I've got a real life cheers in mine. A human intelligence source. Yeah, and all these things that we learnt, and AC12, anti-corruption, there are anti-corruption, I don't think they're called that, but there are anti-corruption
units
in the police force, and they bloody need to be, because there has been so much corruption. The Met is absolutely rife, I'm afraid, and they haven't fixed it. It's not been fixed.
Do you know what? It's Australia too, because that series that you made reference to and never knew the name of, Underbelly.
Oh,
that
yes.
That is based on real life corruption in the police force as well.
Yes.
But that we'll save that for another podcast. No, look, you're right. There's absolutely some real life stories that inspired Jed Mercurio.
Yeah.
And look, if we go right back to series one,
yeah.
The very first scene.
Help me, Tony.
The very first scene in the very first episode was based, according to Jed Mercurio, and look, it's loosely based,
yeah,
but he did base it on the shooting of Jean-Charles de Menezes.
Oh yes, this is just after 7/7, wasn't it, where they were really hunting down terrorists.
Exactly, back in 2005. And look, yeah. I really remember this
because it was just one stop down from your tube station, Stockwell, wasn't it?
That's right. So I just recently moved to London and a few years earlier, and I was living in Brixton. And like you had said, to put his death into context, 2 weeks before Jean-Charles was shot, it was the London 7/7 Islamist suicide bombings on the tube and in Tavistock Square, on the buses, and all of London was on high alert.
Yeah.
And then I didn't actually know this, or maybe I did, but I'd forgotten. The day before he was shot, There were some failed bombing attempts on the tube at Warren Street and Oval and Shepherd's Bush.
Yeah.
And also on some buses. Why can't I bloody talk the buses? The buses. It's because I was going to say buses on Bethnal Green. So
that's difficult. That's a hard sentence.
Yeah, look, and there were apparently some explosions, some minor ones, but no one was hurt. So London was freaking out at the time.
My parents were over that week.
No.
Yeah, and they believe they saved my life because my tube was to King's Cross and mm-hmm. the buses from King's Cross. There's some of my colleagues at Miss 60, because our headquarters were in King's Cross at the time. Some of my colleagues got off the tube and got onto a bus that was behind or in front of the bus blew up, and they saw it and they had to get counselling and all sorts of things. Yeah.
You'll remember then, like, that time, everyone, like, all of London was freaking out. So were the cops. And they were on a manhunt for these terrorists. And, look, in short, when it comes to Jean-Charles de Menezes, they identified the wrong guy. They thought he was a terrorist. And they shot him 7 times in the head at Stockwell Tube.
In the tube station.
7 times. Yeah. And, look, and there was so much misinformation about it. And it was shocking because, you know, like you said, Brixton was my tube stop. And that morning it was closed. So he had actually tried to get on the tube at Brixton. Mm. And then he had to walk to Stockwell. And it was an epic fuck up, the whole thing. He walked to the tube. They thought he was a terrorist. They'd identified the wrong guy. He got shot in the head. Innocent guy. So circling back to Line of Duty, in episode 1, Steve Arnott, he's working in counterterrorism unit, and he orders a firearms team to raid the flat of a suspect. But they read the flat number wrong, and because the number's hanging off in a weird way, and they end up raiding flat 56 instead of flat 59. And when, like, they ram raid the door, when they go in, they mistake a dude who is
cradling a baby.
He's cradling a baby, but he's got the baby harness on, and they think it's a bomb, a bomb vest, and they kill him. Then Chief Inspector Philip Osborne demands that the team lie to cover it up. And that's where Steve
is our hero.
Yeah, Steve's like, no, mate, I can't not tell the truth about what happened.
And then he's recruited by Ted Hastings in the AC-12 anti-corruption unit, and that's how it starts.
Exactly. So that was based on, like I said, the real life shooting of Charles de Menezes.
Why did they pinpoint Menezes? He was a Brazilian. He's Brazilian. I believe, and he was an electrician working in London.
Yep.
What was he wearing that day? They were saying in the papers
that it was a hot summer's day, and they said he had a long, thick trench coat on. Turns out he didn't.
No.
They thought he was hiding bombs under this big heavy trench coat. He wasn't even wearing it. That's what I mean about misinformation at the time. They made all these stories up, but the truth really came out that he was just misidentified. And I think that he had either a name similar, or he was living close to some other Islamists. I mean, he doesn't even look.
They targeted him.
Yeah,
as an individual, and went after him.
Yep, they followed him. They followed him to Brixton, then followed him to Stockwell. God. And then they didn't want to let him get on the tube, so they shot him in the tube. And it was so horrifying because London has a history of the
terrorism.
Well, obviously in Brixton, first of all the bomb IRA. Attacks on the tube, the IRA, then local uprisings and, you know, like the riots in Brixton in the 80s.
Yeah.
I mean, even when I've been living in Brixton, we had the looting right outside my flat. And why Brixton is always a flashpoint and a hotspot for all this is because right outside my flat in Brixton for many, many, many years until really the last year or two, there were memorials on that tree outside the Brixton police station.
Uh-huh.
And Brixton Police Station is where they get Plixton. What the fuck is that?
The guns of Plixton.
The buns of Plix. Buns of what is happening? I haven't even been drinking this morning. Anyway,
could have fallen
outside
me.
My flat. Yeah. Outside, I live right.
Well, you live outside the police station, which is lots of fun.
I do. I do. Well, you say that, but it is. Over the years, I've seen some shocking things. And Black Deaths in Custody, there was a really famous Black Death in Brixton, the cells in Brixton Police Station. So that's why there is always people rallying and, you know, it's really, really awful. But speaking of that, another plot line in the most recent series was the case of Stephen Lawrence. And in series six, and sorry, spoiler alert, if you haven't watched it. Yeah, it's Detective Constable Chloe Bishop tells Steve Arness there's an historic case about a young black man called Christopher Lawrence, who's been attacked outside a railway station in 2003 by a gang of white youths. She goes on to say that the police assumed his death was gang related, but it was later revealed that Christopher had nothing to do with gangs. He was actually an architect who'd never had any trouble with the law. And then one of the most upsetting lines of the last series was when she was talking to Steve Arnott about how the officers had just left this young kid who'd been attacked by a white gang to die in police custody, and that they'd made monkey noises. Yeah. And he said, "Are you okay?" And she's like, "How could anyone be okay?"
Yeah, that was amazing.
It was like goosebump moment in that series. And this actually relates back to two cases.
Mm-hmm.
So the first case of Stephen Lawrence. Look, Jeremy Curio has used the name of two cases and joined
and
them
together.
And
mixed them together, yeah.
Yeah, so we've got Stephen Lawrence and then we have Christopher Alder.
Yeah.
So the Stephen Lawrence case was one of the most famous cases in the UK, and it's still talked about today. Mm-hmm. Institutionalized racism within the police force. And actually, Stephen Lawrence was a black 18-year-old A-level student who wanted to be an architect.
Yeah.
Mm. And he was attacked by a gang of white kids.
Mm-hmm. They were just a bunch of racists in the street, and they just approached him. Yeah. And his friend who he was with ran away, but Stephen, unfortunately, was stabbed and left for dead.
Yeah.
By the gang.
And actually, yeah, he was.
Because they both feared for their lives. And everybody knew who was responsible, but no one said anything. And it was down to the family, wasn't it?
Yep.
Doreen and Neville, I think his name is. Lawrence. Sorry, I know so much about this because I lived in the area when it happened.
Well, actually, there were things like people knew and had left the names of the kids who had beat him up on the windscreen of police cars.
Yep.
And it was ignored. And this is what really ignited the extreme reaction of the public, was that how could the police turn a blind eye simply because it was a black kid who got beaten up by white kids? And it was awful. And actually, when I did some research, this happened in 93.
Mm-hmm.
93. You would have just moved to the UK at this point.
I was there for a few years, and I was well and truly living in the area. So I remember everything about it happening and the aftermath. Doreen, the mother, she's now a Labour peer.
Yeah, right.
And she had an amazing speech at some point, because it was a long haul for that family. She made this incredible speech that predates all of the Black Lives Matter. Yeah. She basically said that. She said, "Why don't we matter? Yeah. Why does it matter? Why is the law just there for the white people? Why is it not there to protect us and our children?"
Well, it was shocking. And she was absolutely right. She's become such a well-known advocate for pushing for investigations into black deaths in custody and everything. Yep. But in terms of this case, it wasn't until 2012 that only two of the kids in the gang were finally convicted of Stephen's death after years of that family campaigning. So for me...
And do you remember when they walked free the first few times they'd been in court, in and out of court? And of course, there were so many reasons why they had to let them go. And they'd come out cheering and smiling, and they were it was disgusting.
But you know what? It wasn't... Do you remember? We always like slag off the Daily Mail, but actually it was the Daily Mail that ran that front page.
They printed their names.
Yep. Who said murderers. The Mail accuses these men of killing. If we are wrong, let them sue us. And they named those five kids, and one of those kids
sued. They never sued.
That was actually one moment where the media has actually been used for good. You know, one key moment.
One facet of the media. Mm. Because as you'll find out when I tell my little tale later on, News International, run by Rupert Murdoch, are the biggest criminals out there, and they are in cahoots with the police, particularly the Met, the Metropolitan Police, which is the city's police force. Yeah, so I don't know who owns the Daily Mail. I know that they've got quite right-wing views that I don't agree with, But in that occasion, and they did good. The Guardian, yeah. they have journalists who end up losing their jobs in order to tell the truth. Yeah. So when we've got the mainstream media, which people always look at with disdain, we need them. We absolutely need the media. They are there to speak for us as people against the, you know, the politicians and government. They're the voice of the people. But unfortunately, things do go wrong, as we all know.
Well, but
Jed Mercurio knew.
Well, it's corruption as well on a level with the media, because as we've seen in recent years, you can tell one side of a story, and if you've got the biggest voice, that's a story that gets heard. So, and you can bribe journalists to give a certain angle. You know, not everybody is telling the truth in the media, obviously.
No.
So
I discovered during my research that in News International, that they've got things like the News of the World, Sun, I think they've even got the Times, I'm not sure. But in that time, when in the 90s in particular, they were loving all these drugs and guns and celebrities and all that kind of thing. Royals. Piers Morgan was running the News of the World at the time. He loved a story about royals. That's when, you know, they got done for phone hacking because they were using such underhand tactics that they were going into people's voicemails, or they were pretending to be people and ringing up their mortgage companies, ringing up the bank. Yeah. Acting, getting all the information, and they were using it against them. Or if the editor would be screaming out these poor journalists so badly that if they didn't have an exclusive story to give, they'd go out, and rather than get screamed at and belittled and bullied by their editor, they would go out and get their friends to dress up as gangsters.
Oh, God.
They'd go to the local sink estate, they'd buy some cocaine or whatever they could, and they'd photograph their friends exchanging drug deals and give it back to the paper.
Crazy.
It's ridiculous. Rather than be bawled out by their boss. That's how bad the bullying culture was within that.
Yeah. They're all in cahoots.
They are, absolutely. As will become clearer when I start to tell you the story that I've got today, which is my line of duty story. Mm-hmm. Britain's most investigated murder. In the last series that just happened.
Series six.
Series six. They go to Gail Vella was the murdered journalist, right?
Who is connected to Jill Dando. That Jed Mercurio did base that. And when anyone who doesn't know, Jill Dando is actually a well-known TV journalist and presenter. Died, shot outside her home in 1999.
Crime Watch. Mm. She was doing Crime Watch, which would have upset all the criminals because she'd be out there exposing them. But that's true.
Yeah, back to you. That was the Gail Vella angle and the real life.
Yeah. She was shot on her doorstep, Jill Dando. Yeah. So was Gail Vella in the series six. And she was uncovering corruption that she'd discovered. Mm-hmm. What was her name again? Chloe Bishop. Yes. DC Chloe Bishop. And at the time, DS, soon to be DI.
Steve Arnott.
Steve Arnott, our hero, turned up to the television production company where Gail Vella worked as a journalist and spoke to her producer, who said that Gail had been working on a podcast because she'd heard a podcast about the murder of Daniel Morgan. And that prompted her to do her own podcast. The podcast they're talking about is a real podcast, and it's called Untold by journalists Peter Jukes and Devia Mir.
Okay.
And that's the thing I've been listening to for the last two weeks. It's incredible. Okay. And also, there's a book that's been written by two ex-Guardian journalists, Laurie Flynn and Michael Gillard, called The Untouchables, which covers Stephen Lawrence, John Charles de Menendez, probably Dando's in there. Definitely this case, Daniel Morgan's in there. It's the Bible of corruption. Fuck. So they lost their jobs at The Guardian.
Yeah, right.
Because they couldn't understand why no one else is touching this. You'd get people who did work at The Guardian or somewhere more reputable moving to a News International paper, gone quiet, lost interest in all these stories because they're not allowed
to
tell
them. They're being silenced. Because the editors are too scared. Because you think about it. Yes, we watch Line of Duty and, you know, we're all involved and wrapped up in these storylines because it feels like fiction. But in a real life situation...
It's based on real life.
But if you've got a real life situation and you're a journalist and you think, okay, I can tell I can tell the truth and reveal this story, or I can not end up in a fucking grave.
Yeah, I can be killed, or my family can be ruined, or my reputation can be ruined, because the papers have the ability to do that, like I just said before, with regards to the phone tapping. And that's what they did throughout this story. Do you want to hear about who Daniel Morgan was?
Yes, please.
He was a young man. Well, he was 37 years old, Welsh chap, but he...
Middle-aged, according to my...
Middle-aged.
According to your dad.
He lived in South Norwood in southeast London with his wife Iris and their two children. And he had a business with his partner, a man called Jonathan Rees.
Okay.
And together they ran a private detective agency in South London called Southern Investigations.
Wow. All right.
So he and John Rees, private detectives, they're not great. They did have illegal access to the police national computer, PNC. They did have access to all sorts of things. I think, I don't know what their background was, but they were running this agency, you know, sorting out jilted husbands and wives and debts and all right. sorts
so
of
they
stuff.
Were just like small time, you know, small personal time. Crimes or
exactly.
investigations. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So Daniel Morgan went to a pub one evening, and then at about 9:40 in the evening of the 10th of March 1987, a pub customer from the Golden Lion pub in Sydenham came out. There was a remote car park attached to the pub. It was remote. It was dark. This pub customer went back to the car park and found Daniel's body lying between his car and another car with an axe embedded in his face.
Oh, my God.
He'd actually been struck three times already in the back with this axe. And as he lay on the ground, the murderer whacked it in one last time. The axe had no fingerprints on it, and it had tape around the handle as well.
Okay.
Next to Daniel's body were a couple of bags of crisps that he bought for his kids, because he had these two little kids at home, and his car keys to his Mercedes. He had fancy cars. He was also a member of the Austin Healey Club, and he had an Austin Healey car as well.
So he was wealthy.
They were making money, yeah.
Right. Okay.
But I believe there were also some debts with the agency. His Rolex
was
gone.
Hang on. So Daniel Morgan owned the PI agency.
He ran the agency called Southern Investigations
with
business partner John Rees.
Right. Yes.
Jonathan Rees.
Yes, got it.
And that's who he was in the pub with that evening. So he was found. So his Rolex was gone.
Okay.
But they found over £1,000 of cash in Daniel's pocket, which they believe was takings. Wasn't a robbery. But the seam of his trousers was ripped, and later on witnesses say that they saw him in the pub and he was making notes, which he put in his trouser pockets. And they were ripped at the seams, and there was no note found on him. One moment, please.
One moment, please.
What's that you say?
Just need to look at my nerds.
Your nerds. So the following day, Daniel's family were informed, and Daniel has a very dogged brother, older brother called Alastair Morgan, who... Without him in the picture, the family wouldn't have uncovered all of the things that they go on to uncover. Okay. So Alastair knew his brother very well. He had done some work in the investigation, in Southern Investigations. He knew John Rees quite well as well. He knew all of the people, but he lived in Hampshire at the time. So he came running up to London. The first thing he did was call John Rees and say, "What the fuck happened to Daniel? You know, this can't be." John Rees told Alastair that his brother had been fatally mugged.
Right. I guess
interesting.
He got mugged with a fucking axe.
With
sorry.
An axe.
Like, what?
I know. Bizarre. So Rees, because he was the last to see him, he was the first to be informed of Daniel's murder. The police went straight round to Rees's house that evening, knocked on the door, told him his business partner had been murdered. Apparently the wife of John Rees was just watching TV the whole time and didn't even bother to look up.
What?
She carried on watching TV. Yeah. Which the police thought was odd.
Yeah.
So they asked him to come to the station.
Yeah.
So he was forensically checked there. He had to be looked over. But the weird thing is they didn't take his clothes. They didn't keep his clothes. They only visually checked them. And that's not usual practice.
Okay. So dodgy from the start here.
Particularly as Rees was the last one to see Daniel alive and they're in a business partnership together. So that's when the next day it gets handed over to the police and the Catford police are at that time run by a man called Detective Superintendent Sid Fillery. So he takes on the case.
Okay.
So the next day they go to Southern Investigations and they clear out a whole box of documents and information from the office. Mm-hmm. And some of those boxes had information regarding a case with a company called Belmont Auctions, which is a car auction company on the banks of London, somewhere in Vauxhall. They had employed Southern Investigations because of a Friday night, they'd have all their cash from their car auctions and they had been robbed trying to take their stuff to the night safe one time.
So they employed Reese
or Southern Investigations. This is Reese, not Daniel Morgan.
Yeah.
To do the job, to like provide security. So Reese had a couple of cop friends because he was very matey with the cops.
Yeah.
And they were doing, his two brothers-in-laws were Gary and Glenn Vian. And they're two kind of like big kind of Mitchell brother type, you know, Southeast London gangster boys. They were into a bit of like drug running and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And so they were the standover men that he took with him for this job. But one night, that was going well for a few weeks. One night, it seemed like the safe had been super glued shut and he dropped off his brothers-in-law's. So he thought, oh, it's safe enough. I'll just bring it home and I'll take it in tomorrow. Yeah. So Reese brought the safe back to his house. But strangely enough, he was robbed on his doorstep and sprayed with ammonia in his face and 18 grand went missing.
Oh, fuck.
So Belmont Auctions weren't happy about that. They smelt a rat. Mm. So they decided to sue Southern Investigations. Daniel Morgan, the partner who had nothing to do with this, thought, well, that's dodgy. You did that off your own back. We don't have the insurance to cover that. Plus, we're in debt. I'm very cross with you about this whole thing. So they were fuming. They had fallen out. So there were scenes of arguments between the two men.
But they had gone to the pub together. So was it, had it been reported that they were matey or had any scenes happened at the pub?
There was an altercation.
Right.
There was an altercation scene. And they had been at the same pub the night before as well. And there was an altercation that night as well. So anyway, Alistair had been aware of this situation with Belmont Auctions and he knew that his brother wasn't happy. He also did know before, in the days running up to Daniel's death, that he was very agitated because he'd learnt something about one thing and one thing only, Michelle. Bent coppers.
Now we're sucking diesel.
So Daniel had got some information. He wouldn't tell Alistair. And he used to tell Alistair everything, but he did not tell Alistair what he knew. And he was acting very cagey and he was throwing out lines like, there's something amiss here or I'm going to get to the bottom of this or whatever. And in the meantime, John Reese, Alistair noted that he was throwing shade on Daniel's life. He was saying things about drug use. Now, Daniel wasn't a drug user. He was saying things about love affairs and jealous lovers, lots of women. Turns out his marriage was in trouble and he did have a girlfriend. Daniel had a girlfriend called Margaret Harrison, who saw him just before he left to go to the pub that fatal night.
Fateful night.
Mm. So he was seeing one lady, but not lots of ladies. And it was known.
It happens. You know, it's not great, but...
Not great. But this was making Alistair suspicious. And during one conversation, Reese told Alistair, after the murder, that when he was taken to identify the body, strangely it was Reese, not one of the family members, gone to ID the body, that he said they'd left the axe in his face or something like that.
Oh. God.
Which is quite shocking and upsetting to tell him. But that wasn't true because witnesses later say that the body had been post-mortemed. It had been cleaned and suited. There is no way he went in to view a body, to identify a body with an axe in the face.
Okay, so how did he even know there was an axe in the face?
Don't know.
See, there we go.
Suspicious. So Alistair took his suspicions to Sid Fillery, the detective that was investigating the case and the other police force. But he was under suspicion when he turned up and he noticed they weren't taking notes. They didn't seem interested in what he had to say and they were deflecting. Yeah. This guy, Sid Fillery, sent him away. King of Catford, he's known as. And then a few days later, Sid Fillery makes a phone call to the family and says, listen, I knew your brother, Daniel.
Yeah.
And I'm going to move heaven and earth to get this investigation solved. But could you please do me a favor? Get your brother, Alistair, out of town. He's muddying the waters. We're finding it difficult to do our job.
Yeah.
So the family were like, oh, bloody hell, Alistair, what are you doing?
Yeah, keep your nose
everything.
Out of it. Yeah.
Keep your nose out. And he was like, no, fuck you. I know something's amiss. I know more about this case than you guys do because I've been on the ground and Daniel's been telling me stuff. Something's up. I'm staying put. And good. He did.
Good for him. Stood his
ground. A few days later, he was walking past a newsagent's and he noticed headline after headline after headline after headline. 6 people had been arrested for Daniel's murder, but no police had picked up the phone to tell the family. Another red flag.
Yep.
So he was looking for the names. And like the Stephen Lawrence case, no one would name. Except one paper. Our favourite. The Daily Star.
Oh, Daily Star.
The Star.
The Star.
Full of shit.
Bastion of quality journalism.
But they were the only paper to reveal the names of the 6 suspects who had been arrested. And it was, surprise, surprise, Jonathan Rees, his brothers-in-law, Gary and Glenn Vian, and 3 serving police officers, probably those who were involved in the Belmont auctions scandal.
Right.
One of them, the detective on the case, Sid fucking Fillery.
No.
Yeah.
Okay. Fucking hell.
Turns out he had conveniently wrapped up a murder the day before Daniel was killed, leaving him free to investigate Daniel's murder. And it also turns out, Michelle, that he was the 3rd man in the pub that night.
Holy shit. Institutionalized and systemic corruption in the police force. Fucking hell.
Sid Fillery. Oh, you'll be pleased to know that all of these men are now are walking free, by the way. None of them have been convicted after. God. And when I say it was the most investigated murder in Great Britain, there have been 5 known inquiries into this murder. 5. From 1987, Michelle.
Yeah.
And it's still going.
Don't tell me, did Fillery put, was he the one who put the axe in the head?
Well, no. Okay. They believe it was Gary Vian.
Jesus Christ.
But it was organised by Rees and covered up by Fillery. That's the upshot. So Fillery was a deeply unpleasant man and had a reputation already for corruption, drunkenness and framing suspects.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, he also gets done for making indecent images of young boys.
Oh,
so he's also into porn.
God. Yeah?
So he gets a suspended sentence for that. Doesn't even do time for that.
Fucking hell.
Community order. Anyway, all 6 suspects were released without charge.
But, you know, there's always some kind of sexual abuse allegations because, you know, even line of duty.
Can get away with.
Even in the line of duty where, you know, there was like all of those connections with the Jimmy Savile case.
Yeah.
And the police were involved on every level facilitating all that shit. I mean, that's the thing with Jeb Mercurio. He does not have to look far to have more material than he could ever use. For line of duty. He couldn't even make enough series to cover all of the shit that's going on.
I know. That's why I believe we've got more series to come. Anyway, so there's a year later, finally, there's a coroner's inquest at Southwark Court.
Mm-hmm.
On that day it started, the Morgan family discovered that Sid Fillery has since left the police force. He went off sick and joined Southern Investigations, Michelle. He replaced Daniel.
Oh, my God. God. Brazen.
It's believed that Daniel had uncovered information about corrupt police officers being paid off by organised crime gangs, smuggling up to £100,000 worth of cocaine into the country. They had customs officials and police turned on their books, allowing this to happen.
This is just tick, 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 line of duty. Tick. I feel like I'm reading a script. You're reading a script. Fuck.
Daniel believed that this story was worth £250,000 and was reluctant to sell to a paper because he was going to go to the police. Well, he wasn't going to go to the police with it.
Well, that's in the days when papers actually paid for stories.
And then papers also got court cases and things off the ground, you know, because they'd print it and then
papers were influential back then.
Yeah. Then they'd have to go and investigate anyway. He didn't tell anyone about it, not even Alistair, due to the dangerous and sensitive nature of the information. So it's discovered also that Rees is on a £150,000 a year retainer with News of the World. They are the main clients after Fillery.
God.
When Fillery and Rees are in there, they are in direct cahoots with most of the red top rags, but primarily News of the World.
Fucking hell.
And in particular, a very regular visitor to the offices is the investigations editor, a very dodgy man called Alex Marinchak, who is one of the guys involved in the phone hacking scandals and would do anything to get a story. So he and Reese and Fillory, tight as thieves.
Jesus
Quite
Christ.
Literally. God. He's one of 26 former News of the World journalists to be arrested in the wake of the phone hacking scandal, which happens later in my timeline. So the News of the World would maintain a stable of private eyes who regularly broke the law on their behalf. And this is under the editorship of people like Piers Morgan, who loved the royals. They had a PI called Glenn Mulcair, who specialised in voice message hacks.
Fucking hell.
While other, I told you before about them, you know, hacking their way into, or faking their way into bank accounts and mortgage companies. And Southern Investigation had bribed police officers on their books.
Oh, man. And this, and we have to also put this into context. This was a time when the world was a little more innocent in terms of you could just ring up a bank and give a story and they might give some details. You know, the security in the world was just less.
A bit more lax.
Yeah.
There were police officers also who were assigned to royal protection duty or politicians protection duty, and they've all been bribed into telling stories as well. When the TV presenter Dil Dando was murdered, News of the World, Reese assured the News of the World that he had one of his best mates as part of the investigation. There was also another police officer who had been on the drug squad, and he'd been looking into the Vian brothers because they were heavily involved in drug smuggling. And I think he also uncovered the information that Daniel Morgan knew about this huge £100,000 job bringing stuff into the country. And his name was Detective Constable Alan Taffy Holmes. Taffy because he's another Welshman. Somehow, and it couldn't be proven for many years, but it has been proven by their colleagues, Daniel and Alan Holmes, Taff, I'm going to call him from now on, knew each other. And they were working together on this story that they were going to sell to the tabloids.
How crazy is it that selling a story to a newspaper can be
means you end up getting killed.
Well, but more than that, like, people think it's a great way to just earn a buck, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's so fucked up.
I think on every level. You earn a buck, but you also expose it at the same time. So I don't really know why these people were. I mean, Taff Holmes, he was a Mason, and so was a colleague of his called Derek Haslam, who is quite integral in this story because he gets fucked over during this time. He's another policeman who he is doing some sort of investigation, and they've got a big boss called Ray Adams. He's the commander of the police at the time. He is the guy that's really twisted and really dark. He ends up leaving and going to work for News International, Murdoch's company, as some kind of security guard. And he gets involved in all sorts of things. But at this time, in the 80s, he's the big boss. He's setting these policemen against each other. He's setting Taff against Haslam. And eventually, Ray Adams is also involved in the cover-up for Stephen Lawrence's murder as well. You'll find his name mentioned around that time.
Yep.
Because he's mates with the OCGs. One of them, there's a guy called Clifford Norris. His son was one of the guys who was the five in Stephen Lawrence's murder.
Oh, Jesus.
That's why it never would come out. And if you topple one of those dominoes, they all come down.
But this is exactly the line of duty storyline, you know?
Exactly.
Fucking
and they
hell.
Were after him. They're called Compliance and Investigation Bureau Team. That's your AC-12.
Yeah.
They were after Ray Adams. Ray wanted to know what they had on him.
Yeah.
He'd pitted. Haslam was part of the team working for, I think, the compliance team, or he was supplying some tapes and information. Taff was coming to Haslam saying, show me those tapes. He was like, oh, I can't. Some problems were happening. But in the meantime, Taff was also going to Daniel Morgan and saying, I know about this. Let's go and get 250 grand.
So hang on. So
the reason why I'm telling you this convoluted story.
Yeah.
It's because 4 months after Daniel's murder, Alan Holmes, Taff, was found dead in his garden by his wife with a shotgun wound to his chest.
Oh, fucking
the shotgun hell. Next to his body was wiped
clean.
Wiped clean. No, not even his own. It was classed as a suicide, but there weren't even any of his own fingerprints on there.
No.
And police will tell you, because they've attended so many suicides, if they were ever going to commit suicide, it would be a gun in the mouth. Because you can't make any mistakes.
Nope. And also, if you shoot yourself, whether it's in the chest or the mouth, you're already dead. So you don't conveniently, like, just put the shotgun beside you.
No.
It's all wrong.
It's
all wrong.
It is totally wrong. And there was a suicide note that named Alex Derek Haslam, the man I mentioned before. So he was hounded out of the police force and out of London before going on to assist the Morgan investigation by going deep undercover for 9 years as a covert human intelligence source, otherwise known as...
A cheese!
A cheese! Does anybody know what's actually going on here?
Does she?
Eavesdropping.
Why? No one knows.
Eavesdropping. What? But I was just going to say to you, so this guy, Ray, he is basically the Tommy Hunter of the story.
He is a policeman, so no.
Oh!
The Tommy Hunter is Clifford Norris.
Right.
Who is the father of one of the Stephen Lawrence's
suspects.
Oh, Geordie,
I can't keep up.
It is so convoluted.
So
it's like watching all six series of A Line of Duty all together.
Because there's so
many. But basically,
many
all
names.
You need to know, there's a lot of names. So I'm not even telling you half of them. There's another one that you need to know called OJ, otherwise known as Obnoxious Jock Davidson, his name is.
Okay.
What's his name? I can't remember. He is one of the other dodgy policemen. He was involved in Lawrence's murder. He's also somehow connected to the Morgan murder. Those two murders are linked by the police officers who worked above, who were able to cover up, fuck it up, change things around. News of the World, Alex Marinchek, he's also involved because he's been, anytime anyone gets close to it, he'll dig up some dirt.
Yep. And deflect with a different kind of story.
But here's another interesting fact. I know I'm getting all over the shop and I'm trying not to go down too many rabbit holes, but the girlfriend, Margaret Harrison, that I mentioned earlier, the last one to see, you know, the last, apart from John Rhys, to see Daniel Morgan alive, she was also seeing John Rhys.
No.
At the same time.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
And guess
sake.
What?
What?
Within months of Daniel Morgan's murder, she left her husband, John Rhys left his wife, and they both married and they're still living together today.
Fucking hell.
So if she's not dodgy.
No, she's completely dodgy. She was, what do they call it? She was the honeypot.
Honeypot. Exactly. I'd say it was a long game.
She was used to get him so she could get insider, you know, like bedroom info.
Yep.
Oh.
So anyway, in the meantime, Rhys and Fillery. Remember Sid Fillery, the King of Catford, the dodgy DI, and Rhys, the business partner.
Yes.
They worked for years supplying stories and training News of the World journalists in the dark arts of phone hacking and then computer hacking.
Okay.
With Alex Marinchak, they had a mutual system to distract or defame anyone who got in their way.
No.
At one point, Jonathan Rhys was so incensed at being arrested initially for Daniel's murder that he launched a campaign against the arresting officers with the News of the World and planned to plant drugs in their car. There has been evidence found over the last 35 plus years, but every time it's brought to court, it's always a dud, always thrown out of court because of insufficient evidence or some kind of legal loophole.
And
compromised somehow.
But you
somehow.
Know what? There are so many cops involved in this that there will be no way for it to ever get to some kind of conviction because there will be someone who is squashing it from within the police force, from within the legal system. Judges can be bribed as well. You know, it's so fucking terrifying.
So listen, I'm going to wrap it up with a quick timeline.
Okay.
I'll just give you this quick timeline because there's so many more things that to tell you which I can't even fit in this episode. But basically, you start in March 87, Daniel's murdered. April 97, Crime Watch do a reconstruction, but Daniel is almost unrecognizable with a dragging limp because he had a club foot, but it was hardly noticeable. But they had this guy like dragging his foot along behind him on Crime Watch. And finally, the family realised that Rhys had given all the information. He also waged a very cruel war against the family over the years as well, doing things like putting his cigarette out on Daniel's mother's coat in the court.
What?
They paid for some elaborate, ugly, floral tribute of a harp with a broken string, which was some kind of in-joke on top of Daniel's funeral cortege, which is the family
Nasty.
Knew nothing about. He wanted to go around and break the news to Daniel's wife.
Fucking hell.
Somebody was ringing the mother over the years, playing Danny Boy down the phone. At one point, Alistair and his partner, when they lived in Islington, had a woman calling up and threatening to kill them because Alistair never let up. He was the one that kept getting his MPs involved, contacting people. He would not let it go.
Now, you said, though, that No one's ever been convicted of this murder.
But everyone knows it's the worst kept secret in Southeast London.
Well, who did it? Tell me.
Murder, everybody knows. John. Well, they believe that Gary Vian held the axe,
and that John put it through.
Glenn Vian was the accomplice. Mm. There's a man called James Cook, Jimmy Cook, who was the driver, who actually later on supplied evidence, but that had to be thrown out of court. Mm. And John Rhys was the instigator, with assistance through the police by Sid Fillery. So it's those guys. The initial six that were arrested, apart from two policemen who were involved in the moonlighting scam for Belmont Auctions, they're the ones. They had the right guys from the beginning. Anyway, let me go back to my timeline.
Yes.
April 87, six people arrested. July 87, DC Ian Taff Holmes' apparent suicide. Then in April 88, a year later, the bookkeeper from Southern, Kevin Lennon, told the court that Rhys had organised to kill his partner. All you need to know is Lennon turned up and gave loads of facts and information. But Lennon was the bookkeeper. You need to keep up, Michelle.
I can't. He was Southern. So much. Jeez, I'm sorry.
Kevin Lennon was the star witness for the first coronial inquest, but that all had to be thrown out of court.
Oh, God.
June 88. The Met refers the case to a watchdog after the Morgan family made allegations against the police.
Right.
In 89, after Alistair lobbied his MP, Hampshire police begin an investigation into police incompetence. And this is called the Hampshire Report. Mm-hmm. They concluded that there was no police misconduct, but plenty of cock-ups, and it was handled dreadfully. The family want to see this report, but they were always denied.
I wonder when the statute of limitations allows them to see it.
Well, they did see it eventually, but it was all redacted. And there were loads of things they weren't allowed to see. In 94, The Guardian wrote an article, and Islington's MP Chris Smith got behind the case, and the new police chief commissioner, Paul Condon, said that the inquiry was compromised and admitted up to 250 corrupt police officers were in the Met. Out of 40,000, that's a very small figure. We think he might have been downplaying it somewhat. Mm. The third inquiry is in 1999. Mm-hmm. And because of all the scandals, the Met had to start this anti-corruption unit. And that was known as the Ghost Squad.
Okay.
That's almost like our AC-12. They almost had him at one point. They ran the Ghost Squad. They bugged houses. They had Derek Haslam, the previous officer, Innes the Chiz. He worked there for so many years. He had so much information and tape upon tape upon tape. But unfortunately, during this particular inquiry, mm-hmm. they uncovered there's a jeweler who employed Southern Investigations to sort out his ex-wife.
Sort out?
This jeweler employed Southern because he was having a custody case. So Southern decided to get the ex-wife put in prison by planting drugs in her car and setting her up as a drug dealer, which meant that an innocent woman would go to prison and her son would then her ex-husband would have custody of the child. Now, they uncovered this while they were investigating Daniel's murder, and all the tapes that were relating to Daniel's murder had to be given up in evidence for this heinous crime. The only good thing that came out of this is that Rhys went to prison for 7 years.
Right.
For attempting to pervert the course of justice.
But never for Morgan.
No. Oh. And unfortunately, while he was in prison, he had a high time making new contacts.
Yeah.
Sorting people out, saying, oh, when I'm out, everything will be fine. When he got out, News of the World employed him again.
Fucking hell.
So he only did 5 years of his 7-year thing. Then in 2001, there's a fourth inquiry. Then in 2002, there's a great detective by the name of Dave Cook who appears on Crime Watch. Jill Dando is no longer there, but there's another policewoman that works on the programme called Jackie Hames. The day before he appeared on Crime Watch, News of the World and Southern went about trying to usurp him, Dave Cook. So they found out some information and they went for the angle, he's having an affair with Jackie Hames.
Right.
The policewoman on Crime Watch. But guess what, Michelle?
What?
They're married. There's no story. They're married. But that didn't stop the News of the World and Southern from making loads of phone calls to uncovering all this information about them. They had men in balaclavas jumping about in their garden, scaring the hell out of their children. They had men at the front with cameras, surveilling them, photographing them. It was a nightmare. And in fact, they heard a rumor that Alex Marinchak was going to try and sort them out.
Oh, God. This, honestly, like, I can't keep up. It's so fantastical.
It's too much.
It's so fantastical that it's hard to even believe that this is real life. It does just sound like...
It's connected to the government as well, because Andy Coulson, who became editor of the News of the World after Rebecca Wade, now Brooks, left, became the spin doctor for Dave Cameron. David Cameron allowed another report, a two-part... He started the phone hacking scandal report, the Leveson Inquiry. There's two parts to it, but they all reneged on the second part. We only ever heard one part of it. Mm. That's another story, Michelle.
Oh, my God.
Another story.
So
I'm going to wrap it up.
Shorty.
I'm going to wrap it up because there's more on my timeline. Eventually, Fillory does get arrested for attempting to pervert the course of justice in 2006, but I don't think he gets jailed. There's supergrasses, policemen, ex-News of the World journalists who become whistleblowers.
It goes
every
on
time
and
the,
on.
Keir Starmer, the leader of the Labour Party, was involved. He was the head of the public prosecutions at some point during the Daniel Morgan inquiry.
It's like the public has short memories, though. You know?
Well,
like...
I'm just going to flip forward because the last thing you need to know is that recently, in 2013, I think, because I've lost my timeline now. The family go to Theresa May, who is then the Home Secretary, and beg her to start another report on this whole thing because they know that there's been incompetencies and corruption within the police, aided by the News of the World and Southern Investigations.
Yeah.
She's reluctant to take it on, but then Hillsborough happens. So then she takes it on. She commissions the report, then says that it will be ready in 2016. Yep. But it wasn't ready in 2016 because in the meantime, you know, Brexit happens. She becomes prime minister, blah, blah, blah. And it's now ready. It is now ready to be released into the public domain. But our now Home Secretary, Priti Patel, who happens to be good friends with the Murdochs, she attended a wedding of one of the Murdochs. I think it was actually, who married Jerry Hall for 5 minutes? Was it one of the sons or was it Rupert Murdoch himself? I can't remember.
It might have been Rupert. Anyway, who fucking knows?
Well, she was at that wedding.
Right.
Priti Patel. So the report is ready to be released to the public. It's been checked over by police for security, but she's saying she wants to check it before releasing it for security and possible human rights violations. But that's not her job. Her job is just to release it. But she's holding it off. And I haven't heard anything since. That's the last thing I've heard.
When was this all kicking off? When was it meant to be released?
2 weeks ago.
Oh, fucking hell. Oh, Geordie, everyone's in cahoots.
So
Everyone's in cahoots,
yeah.
Everyone's got something at stake.
It's connected to so many things. And, you know, a lot of those policemen who are up high have probably already retired. Off the fat of the land, the fat of the OCG money and all their corruption. But it would just reveal so much about our police and what has been allowed, that what they've been allowed to get away with, and the injustices to families like Stephen Lawrence and Daniel Morgan's families, that how could we ever trust them again?
Well, but this is all line of duty stuff, you know, like they have to have the visuals on this, which is there's no corruption. Cannot admit it because people will lose trust. But people already have so little trust in the police force. You know, they...
And the media.
And even the law, you know, the justice system. You know, we look at this, but until we've actually been a part of it, I think we... And had injustice done to us, it's hard to put ourselves in their shoes because... We see all these documentaries. We see Line of Duty. We've all seen Making a Murderer. And, you know, it's the world over. Everyone's fucking corrupt. Go live off the land. Go live off grid. That's the only way forward.
Shoot any trespassers on site.
Yep. No.
Jobs are good. Listen, Michelle, don't act like a tit. We're all on the same side here.
It's true.
And actually, Michelle, stop making a tit of yourself and piss off. I've got all my favourite lines of duty up here. I've got You bent bastard. Oh, at one point during my story,
yeah.
No, there was a really long-winded inquiry that they were dragging their heels on. And then suddenly they discovered that one of the Vian brothers' stepsons was in the police force.
Oh, my God. Ryan Pilkington all over. It's the caddy.
The caddy.
Fucking
so
hell.
If you don't understand what we're talking about this episode, you have to go and watch Line of Duty, really.
And really, from series one, episode one. Got to get in from the beginning.
All the way through. Lenny James, brilliant. Help me, Tony.
Help me, Tony. Jackie Laverty. Love it. There it is. Oh, well, thank you for that amazing story.
Well, you know what? Jesus, Mary and the wee donkey.
He's 10 pounds soaked, ringing wet or whatever. I don't know. Bloody
10 stone ringing wet.
Ted Hastings, what a character, what a legend.
He didn't float up the Laggan in a bubble.
That's true. Oh, well, thank you, Geordie. Amazing work. You should have been a PI in another life.
Well, I'm glad I'm not, because you end up with an axe in the head.
Oh, God.
I'll give that a miss. Thanks, Michelle.
Well, lovely to chit-chat and...
We'll catch you later, Michelle.
Catch you on the flip side.
See you round like a rissole.
Oh, that's a goodie.
Well, whatever you bloody do, just keep
eavesdropping.